Meta has spent upwards of $50 billion developing the metaverse. But will it pay off? Go inside the company in a new three-part series, From Facebook to Meta, Zuckerberg's Big Bet, in the Tech News Briefing feed from The Wall Street Journal.
As Russia begins targeting civilian areas, the U.S. and its allies are rushing arms to Ukraine. But will they get there fast enough?
This is a situation that could change quickly, that we could see a Russian advance that actually exceeds expectations in the days or weeks ahead. This is all very unpredictable.
Plus, why the U.S. hasn't yet sanctioned Russia's oil and gas industry. And how to get back into the rhythm of working in the office. It's Tuesday, March 1st. I'm Anne-Marie Fertoli for The Wall Street Journal. This is the PM edition of What's News, the top headlines and business stories that moved the world today. Russia has made a tactical shift in its assault on Ukraine, pummeling civilian areas in an attempt to demoralize Ukrainian resistance. Russian forces bombarded the city of Kharkiv and hit the TV tower in the capital of Kyiv as part of a plan to target information and communication facilities. Russia's defense minister warned of the attacks, urging local residents to leave for their own safety. Western diplomats are taking that as a sign that a massive strike on Kyiv's residential areas is imminent. Later in the show, we'll talk about the increased military support Ukraine is receiving from the U.S. and its Western allies. The Biden administration and European allies continue to add to the long list of sanctions targeting many of Russia's top financial institutions, including its central bank and Russian President Vladimir Putin himself. Today, Western countries agreed to remove seven Russian banks from SWIFT, the financial messaging infrastructure that underpins the global financial system. But in an EU compromise, they left SWIFT access open for some Russian banks, so Europe would still be able to pay for essential energy imports from Russia. In the U.S., lawmakers on both sides of the aisle are pressing for sanctions against Russia's powerful oil and gas industry and for a ban on Russian oil imports to the U.S. Energy policy reporter Tim Pugo says it's a move Biden has so far avoided.
A lot of concerns come down to energy prices and the power that those have over elections. People in both Europe and the United States have been very concerned about inflation and, at the core of it, energy prices for the better part of the last year. Russia is a really powerful oil and gas producer. It is responsible for about a tenth of the world's entire supply of oil. And so whether it's Europe having less supply or ripple effects from that going around the world, cutting off Russian energy means that there's going to be pain for people at home, both in the U.S. and Europe, and trying to figure out how to manage that. That's the balance here.
The price of oil soared above $100 a barrel again today, trading at eight-year highs. To bring prices down, the U.S. and members of the International Energy Agency have agreed to release 60 million barrels of their emergency stockpiles. It's only the fourth time in its 47-year history the IEA has made such a move and is second in size only to the release it executed during the first Gulf War in 1991. As oil prices soared, U.S. stocks tumbled. The Dow fell nearly 600 points, or 1.8%. The S&P 500 and the NASDAQ each fell 1.6%. Businesses are also reacting to the crisis in Ukraine with their own measures. YouTube parent Google has said it would block online access to the Russia state-controlled media channels RT and Sputnik News across Europe. YouTube's move follows a similar action from TikTok and Facebook parent Meta. Apple says it's also removed RT News and Sputnik News apps from its app store outside of Russia and has disabled traffic and live incidents from its maps in Ukraine. The tech giant has also stopped selling iPhones and other products in Russia. Apple says it's paused all product sales in Russia and last week stopped all exports into its Russian sales channels. And the crisis in Ukraine will be one of the top issues President Biden touches on in his first State of the Union address tonight. Here's Wall Street Journal White House reporter Ken Thomas.
In the speech tonight, President Biden will try to strike the right balance between the U.S. role in pushing back against Russian aggression, along with dealing with inflation, winning confirmation of his Supreme Court pick, and pressing Congress to pass his agenda. White House officials told members of Congress today that the president would offer an optimistic tone. They expect him to argue that it's never a good bet to bet against America and that the country's best days lie ahead. But the speech has been a work in progress in the aftermath of Russia's invasion of Ukraine. We expect the president to talk about how the administration has worked to lead an international response to Russia. And the White House has signaled that the president will talk about the conflict in the context of the role of democracies on the world stage. But there's no question that weaving all of these elements together will be part of President Biden's challenge as he addresses the nation in the annual speech.
Russia's military might exceeds Ukraine's by a factor of 10. With looming attacks on the country's civilian population, the U.S. has promised more military supplies to Kyiv. But the window to get them there is closing fast. We'll have more on that after the break.
Meta has spent upwards of $50 billion developing the metaverse. But will it pay off for the company, its investors, and for CEO Mark Zuckerberg?
Over time, I hope that we are seen as a metaverse company. And I want to anchor our work and our identity on what we are building towards.
Meta's trillion-dollar business and how we use the internet could hang in the balance. Go inside the company in a new three-part series, From Facebook to Meta, Zuckerberg's Big Bet, in the Tech News Briefing feed from The Wall Street Journal.
Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky renewed his call for help before the European Parliament today, telling EU leaders that his compatriots are dying to achieve freedom and equality. The U.S. and its allies have been rushing to provide weapons and military equipment to the Ukrainian army. But there have been challenges, including limited supply routes. Now, as Russia's attacks continue to intensify, there's a question of whether the arms will get there in time and whether there'll be enough. Joining me now with more is Wall Street Journal national security correspondent Nancy Youssef. Hi, Nancy. Thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me.
So, Nancy, let's start with what the U.S. has been doing so far in terms of supporting Ukraine militarily.
So since 2014, the U.S. has been providing on and off defensive weapons to Ukraine, anti-missile weapons, small arms ammunition, javelins, stingers, those kinds of things. And in fact, this year, the U.S. has already committed $550 million in military aid. There was $200 million dedicated to Ukrainian military aid in January and another $350 million in the days after the Russian invasion into Ukraine. I should stress that weapons are considered defensive and not offensive. And one reason for that is that the U.S. fears that if they provide the Ukrainians offensive weapons, that some will perceive that as an act of aggression by the U.S. towards Russia, which has been the thorn in Ukraine's side since 2014 and has made moves on not only Crimea, it has threatened naval presence in the Black Sea and has said that it considers the Donbas region independent. And so for all those reasons, the U.S. has stressed defensive weapons, but stopped short of providing offensive weapons that some could see as more involvement than the U.S. has so far been willing to commit to.
Nancy, Ukraine is not in NATO. President Zelensky has asked for immediate admission into the European Union. Given those realities that Ukraine is not a member of those groups, what are the obligations of the U.S. and Western allies?
So in terms of military defense, because it's not a member of NATO, there is no military obligation. It's under Article 5 of NATO that essentially says an attack on one is an attack on all. As long as Ukraine is not a member, there's no obligation either from the U.S. or from other NATO members. That's sort of the literal obligation. I think the question becomes, what is their moral obligation, and also what is their obligation in terms of the dedication to the idea of democracy. You'll remember that early on in the Biden administration, the president said that the attack on democracy itself was one of the biggest threats that he saw coming into office. And now we're seeing that play out in a very real way in Ukraine. And so the question becomes, how does the president then support what he sees as a central threat to U.S. interests, to the promise of democracy around the world? And so it stops short of invasion or sending troops. According to the Biden administration, they have said as much. But does that mean that they have to do more to support Ukraine than perhaps they would have in light of their feeling and under this administration that it has an obligation to defend attacks on democracies?
What else is on the table right now for the Biden administration as we see attacks intensifying in Ukraine right now?
So I think the short-term one would be more military aid. For example, if and when the $350 million tranche runs out, will we see another commitment by the United States to send more arms to the Ukrainians? Longer term, I think the challenge becomes, if this becomes a protracted conflict, is there a possibility of the U.S. supporting groups on the ground that are fighting Russian forces? That scenario, or sending of offensive weapons, I think potentially opens the U.S. to being seen as an aggressor to Russia. Remember that the U.S. has said it is not looking for conflict with Russia. Does arming opponents on the ground, does sending offensive weapons constitute an attack on Russia? And if so, then that arguably would limit what they can do. But I think in the short term, what you'll see, if there's increased support, there'll be an increased support of more of the kinds of weapons, potentially more sharing of intel, and also just rallying the international community to back the Ukrainian government.
What are some of the challenges that the Biden administration has been facing in supporting Ukraine by sending arms and equipment?
So there's the practical one. This is a country that's under attack, and the U.S. has said that it has no aircraft flying over Ukraine, which means that anything getting in has to go away by way of ground in a very hostile environment. There's the issue of getting it fast enough. This is a fast-moving situation. There were estimates that the Russians believe that they would be able to take control of Ukraine in a matter of weeks. While that effort has faced setbacks, this is a situation that could change quickly, that we could see a Russian advance that actually exceeds expectations in the days or weeks ahead. This is all very unpredictable. And then the other challenges, sometimes more practical ones, the Ukrainian military is built largely on, in terms of small arms fire in particular, Russian-based, Soviet-based, Soviet-modeled weapons, whereas the U.S. and NATO have their own sort of types of ammunition and guns, and those are often incompatible. Sometimes it's a difference of a millimeter between a round used in a Ukrainian weapon versus a U.S. one, which means that there are some areas where the U.S. just doesn't have the kinds of capabilities that would be compatible to what the Ukrainians need. And so in addition to sort of getting things there quickly, they sometimes have to go to NATO partners and allies, maybe former Soviet bloc nations that have excess amounts of these, and get them to Ukraine again quickly and over ground.
Nancy, as you mentioned, President Biden has said repeatedly that he will not send U.S. troops to fight in Ukraine. As we see these attacks escalate, is sending U.S. troops still completely off the table for the Biden administration?
In the short term, at least, it appears to be that that is not an option. And I think given that the president has expressed repeatedly a preference to diplomacy first, a reluctance to engage the military, not just on this, but in other conflicts, there's no indication that the U.S. is moving towards using military force. The forces that we've seen are all in support of NATO allies, and to send a message of deterrence, essentially, to Vladimir Putin that if you go after NATO countries, you're crossing a red line. And we're showing that with the physical presence of U.S. troops in NATO countries that border Ukraine or could potentially be seen as vulnerable. That said, I think as events unfold, it's been, I think, by anyone's estimation, a heartbreaking and stunning series of events we've seen over the few days. If we continue to see the Ukrainians resisting and we continue to see an international community rallying behind Ukraine that has, that doesn't mean that there'll be a military intervention, but I do think that there'll be increased pressure on the Biden administration to do more to tip the scales towards the Ukrainians' favor. Now, how that manifests itself, I don't know. But I want to be clear, I'm not saying that that means that it'll lead to a military option, but I do think it'll lead to more pressure to help the Ukrainians.
Wall Street Journal national security correspondent Nancy Youssef. Nancy, thank you so much for your time today.
Thanks for having me.
And finally, after 2 years of remote and hybrid work, more offices may soon be reopening. Companies like American Express, Meta Platforms, and Wells Fargo say they're planning broader office returns this month. But even though more people are going out, attending sporting events and theaters, executives are finding it difficult to convince their employees to come back in person. Our workplace reporter Chip Cutter says the C-suite has to be flexible.
What the chief HR officer at the networking company Cisco Systems told me. She said that in the past, even during the pandemic, she used to ask her teams to think 90 days in advance about how they might work. She said that's now too long. She's now saying, let's think about how we might work over the next 30 days, knowing that plans could change. There could be another variant. There could be other issues that sort of push people back home, and she wants to be responsive to that. And I think that that sentiment really is what I'm hearing from a lot of different executives right now, that they know that plans may need to be altered once again, but for the moment, they think it's safe to convene workers in person. And so many are trying now to just sort of get people up to speed. American Express, for example, has started a soft trial of bringing people back to its offices as of early March. And then starting March 15th, it's going to go into sort of what it calls its Amex Flex mode, where people will sort of work 1 to 3 days per week in the office. They'll set their schedules with their teams. But I think that's what we're seeing a lot of companies doing. Say, hey, get sort of used to commuting again, try it out, and get ready to be in the office a little more than you have been in the past.
And that's what's news for this Tuesday afternoon. We'll be back tomorrow morning. If you like what you hear, please rate and review us. I'm Anne-Marie Fertoli for The Wall Street Journal.